From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Over the past 3 years, five cities and counties in the state, including Clark County, Reno, and Sparks, have penned agreements with an automated license plate reader company called Flock Safety. Those agreements have brought in a wave of cameras that collect data, such as license plate information, as well as the make and model of passing cars. It then plugs that information into a national database that police can then search for specific vehicles even beyond their jurisdictions. In Clark County, there are at least 200 of these cameras. In Washoe, at least 180. Joining me to talk about what these cameras do, how they work, and how the police are using them is Isabella Aldrete and Una Milliken with the Nevada Independent. Isabella, Una, glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
We dig into the details, Bella, what is an automated license plate reader and how do they work?
Yeah, I think you summed it up pretty well in your intro. Like you said, the cameras scan the license plates of vehicles identifying information as they pass by on the road. This can be the color, the make, the model, and they plug that information into a national database. So for example, if I'm a police officer in Texas with access to this Flock database, I can use that database to look up whether a license plate might have been in Nevada or California or in another nearby state. And this database is huge. There's more than 81,000 of these cameras nationwide, and the number seems to only be growing.
Roughly how many cameras are we talking about in some of these communities around Nevada?
Yeah, so the scope is not entirely clear because it seems to be a mix of different private, public, and law enforcement entities that are using these cameras. But we know that in Clark County, there are at least two that are being used by Las Vegas Metropolitan Police. And in Washoe, there's more than 100. There's a website called DeFlock that I recommend people check out that is an open source map of where these cameras are around your community and has some details about cameras that are used by private entities as well, like malls and shopping areas.
And we'll have a link to that website on our website, knpr.org. Most of these cameras are run by a company named Flock, as you mentioned. As a matter of fact, most people even refer to these as Flock cameras. Una, what do we know about the company itself?
It was founded in 2017. It's a tech company that kind of has license plate readers and shares this information with law enforcement. They've also have, like, now later on, they've started using a program called Flock Nova that also compiles other information alongside the license plate. So that can be information on your name and your address, and that is shared with law enforcement as well.
You know, what's interesting in this particular case is that the cameras operated by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police, or Metro, were a donation from the Horowitz Family Foundation. That means there was no real public discussion about how they'd be used. You know, do we know why the nonprofit bought so many of these cameras, Bella, Una?
We don't really know why, except for the fact that Ben Horowitz and his wife Felicia, who are the kind of runners of the Horowitz Foundation, the Horowitz family, or Horowitz is a tech VC guy, and they're strong supporters of law enforcement. Ben Horowitz is the co-founder of A16Z, which is a VC company. And they're also major investors and stakeholders in Flock, this company. So that's something that should be noted. Sheriff Kevin McMahill has long praised this partnership and called it like the perfect public-private partnership. So there is like a strong bond between the Horowitz Foundation and Metro.
Bella, how are the police using these cameras?
Yeah, so police throughout the country, including Metro, have touted it kind of as an investigative tool to track, you know, suspect vehicles and help solve crimes. In Northern Nevada, police have said they're going to try to lower crime in parks using the technology. And it has been used in some big cases like the Cybertruck explosion last year at the Trump Tower Hotel. But the exact specifics aren't clear because, again, there isn't much publicly available information on how exactly the police are using the technology. I have a public records request asking for instances where police have used this technology, but that has taken months to get back, and it's not entirely clear if we'll get that information.
Could they eventually use these cameras as the same as like maybe traffic enforcement cameras to send drivers tickets?
Yeah, well, currently that's against state law. Under Nevada statute, the government is prohibited from using photographs or digital equipment to, issue a traffic citation or civil citation even, except in very limited circumstances. So we'd have to go to the legislature to see that change.
Una, critics of these cameras say they raise privacy concerns, that data could be used to find undocumented immigrants, political protesters, or people traveling across state lines to obtain abortions. Have police taken any steps to limit how the data is used?
Well, Flock themselves actually have said that they, after some pushback, are not going to be sharing their info with ICE. But if there is a federal warrant, they have to comply with that sort of thing. Some police agencies and other government agencies have kind of put out a portal, saying when they're searching and how many searches are being done. So there's some sort of transparency around how it's being used. Apart from that, especially with Metro, we don't know a ton about how the data is used or what kind of regulations there are within the department. Like Bella, I've submitted public records request on any violations or infractions or any disciplinary action related to Flock use, but it was denied for privacy reasons. That's what they said. So we don't know a ton, honestly.
That is where we're going to have to leave it. Isabella Una, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cloud seeding is on the rise in our region. It's a tool some officials turn to in their efforts to combat drought. But the government agency tasked with keeping track of weather modification is not keeping up with operations. That's according to a new report. The Mount West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has more.
Driving in northern Nevada, Frank McDonough is checking on cloud seeding sites, but notes the sunny skies and temperatures in the 70s aren't ideal.
We need widespread low clouds to be present for us to do cloud seeding.
McDonough leads the cloud seeding division at the nonprofit Desert Research Institute, which operates a half dozen ground-based cloud seeding sites across Nevada.
What you're trying to do is create these small ice crystals inside of a cloud that's full of sub-freezing liquid water drops.
That means more snowpack to create more water in drought-stricken areas. About an hour outside of Las Vegas, DRI is testing equipment. At first glance, this rustic setup looks like a trailer on wheels with a solar panel and a tower topped off with an upside-down looking barrel, but it's deceptively scientific. Field technician Patrick Malarkey opens the trailer and with a few clicks on his laptop, fires up the generator.
We make a flame with a propane burner. We atomize the solution of silver iodide and acetone and spray it into the flame. And it makes a dust like a smoke.
The dust has been found to be safe. The federal government says more research is needed to determine if the widespread use of silver iodide has any effect on public health or the environment. But it can help communities and farmers make it through dry seasons.
It's really the only method there is to increase the amount of water in a watershed. And it's done for less than $10 per acre foot. So if a cloud seeding program can put down 50,000 acre feet in a course of a winter, and that's approximately what the Nevada State program puts down, that's enough water for 150,000 houses use for a year.
That's why there's been a dramatic increase in investment in cloud seeding here. The Nevada legislature 3 years ago allocated about $600,000 to support DRI's efforts. Surrounding states have invested even more. Utah recently allocated $16 million for cloud seeding. and the Federal Bureau of Reclamation provided nearly a $2.5 million grant for cloud seeding operations in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming, all aimed at increasing the levels of Lake Mead, which is fed primarily by the Colorado River.
There are over 1,000 reports in the database.
Karen Howard is with the Government Accountability Office, Congress's own governmental watchdog. The database she's referring to is the one tracking a rising number of cloud seeding and other weather modification projects.
We did a review of those, and we found that the vast majority of them had missing information, incorrect information.
The database has been maintained for decades by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which has recently faced steep budget cuts.
We also found a lot of reports were missing that should have been in there. So we found major problems with the database.
This means a lack of transparency and data-driven guidance. The Mountain West News Bureau reached out to NOAA several times and never received a response. The GAO recommended in its report that NOAA improve its data collection and reporting process, and the agency agreed.
The better we can do at reporting what activities are occurring and doing good, reliable scientific measurements, the more we're going to understand how effective it is and have the confidence that we're getting the bang for the buck that's being invested.
Back in the desert, scientists say some companies are affecting wider areas using planes. But regardless of the advancements, McDonough says it's important to keep any new discoveries in perspective.
So if you add in conservation, cloud seeding, and land use, you could potentially, you know, help people manage a limited supply of water.
And where every drop of water counts, so does every data point. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
For more than 75 years, newspaper readers in Las Vegas could expect a printed edition of The Sun on their doorstep or in their mailbox every day. That run came to an end last Friday, April 3rd, after a federal court ruled that the agreement between The Sun and its chief competitor, the Las Vegas Review-Journal, was, quote, unlawful and unenforceable. That means the RJ no longer has to print and distribute its rival. It's the latest in the long-running antitrust battle between the newspapers. To learn more about the ruling and its impact on The Sun, I spoke with Brian Greenspun. He's the CEO of Greenspun Media Group, which owns The Sun. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
I want to start with something the Las Vegas Review-Journal editor Glenn Cook wrote in the op-ed last Friday, explaining why the RJ stopped printing the paper as of that day. He said, quote, "It's time The Sun stood up on its own 2 feet," end quote. We'll get into the details of the lawsuit later, but I wanted to first get your reaction to that quote.
Wow. I would say this. There is a reason that for the last, since 1990, and certainly since 2005, the people in Clark County have had access to both newspapers, different viewpoints, different takes on stories, different opinions. And that is because the Congress, under the Newspaper Preservation Act, thought it was more important if there were two newspapers in a particular community that those independent voices be kept at almost all costs, including waiving most of the antitrust laws to allow that to happen. So that's how we got to that point. We had this joint operating agreement that was sanctioned by the United States government. What Mr. Cook said is, in my view, a perfect example of why this community needs another voice. I like to think that the Las Vegas Sun does its very, very best to tell the truth to the readers. Mr. Cook and his lawyers and his owners have a very distant relationship with that concept. Is that a nice way of saying it? So when you ask me how I respond to his comment about standing on its own 2 feet. When we did this joint operating agreement in 1990, what the Sun had to do as a result of that the Review Journal demanded, was that we give up our advertising lists, our subscriber lists, and our press and all other capacity for printing our own newspaper as a price to get into this joint operating agreement. In other words, they took over all the means of printing and distribution. So now for them to say many decades later, time to stand on your own two feet. They cut our legs out from under us, and now they're saying, now you have to walk. That's being totally dishonest with their readers and our readers, who are the same people in that newspaper, or were until last Friday.
The legal case between the Review Journal and the Sun is complicated. Let's start with the JOA that the two papers made in 2005. The basic arrangement was that the RJ would print and distribute the Sun as an insert and cover some other overhead while the two papers maintained separate newsrooms. Why did that come about to begin with?
There was a whole spate of events that led up to that, but I'll just talk about the lawsuit. We filed the lawsuit in federal court, an antitrust lawsuit, because we were, in our view, we were given no choice. The Review Journal was going to stop basically printing us that day or the next day or shortly thereafter, after they claimed that we were violating whatever the joint operating agreement was. They made something up. We had no choice. We went to federal court and said they're violating the antitrust laws by trying to shut out their only daily newspaper competitor. Now, that was in 2019, so we filed that lawsuit. So it's been kicking around in court. It hasn't been languishing. I mean, it's up and back. I mean, they're costing us a fortune. But we filed that lawsuit in 2019 to stop them from shutting down the obligation they had to print and distribute us. So it's been in federal court ever since. It's now at a point where there's only one, according to the Ninth Circuit, which is now the law of the case, there's only one joint operating agreement. That's the one both parties signed in 1989 to take effect in 1990 and last until 2040 at a minimum. So that's why that's what we're in court, and that's what we're doing now, and that's what the judge directed us to do as of last week in a hearing, which was if we wanted to file an amended complaint based on what happened, you know, with the 2005 amendment going away, then we have until this morning to file it, which we are doing.
The JOA allowed the Sun to focus on editorial and the RJ to take over ads, giving a small cut to the Sun as revenue. Does this ruling mean the RJ doesn't have to pay you ad revenue it may owe you?
From an advertising standpoint, from a production standpoint, that's what the joint operating agreement was about. The law required two independent newspapers, and that means editorial and reportorial, competing for the printed word, if you will, for the coverage of news and for opinion. Every other form of competition was gone. The Review Journal was charged with doing all that. That was the waiver of the antitrust laws I was talking about, because most businesses can't combine those kind of operations without violating the antitrust laws. Congress said you can violate those antitrust laws because it's more important to have two competing voices. Something we've learned, well, we've known all along, but we certainly learned on Friday when the Las Vegas Sun did not appear in print for the first time in 76 years. We've been hearing from all kinds of readers who said, either the only reason I take the Review Journal is to get the Las Vegas Sun, or I like to read both newspapers. What happened to my newspaper? I mean, people are up in arms, and that's the great harm. It's to the public. I mean, think about it now. You only have a daily newspaper that prints the news the way they see it and editorials the way they see it. And the rest of the community, which we helped build circulation over the last 20, 30, 40 years, is shut out. They don't get that information. That's the result of what happened on Friday.
At this point, is there any sort of relationship left between you and the management over at the RJ?
I haven't talked to the Adelsons in a good long time. They're not in the talking mood. Our lawyers talk all the time because they have to talk. It's not the way it should be, if that's your question. No, people should act like grown-ups. And, you know, listen, when you got a guy with his boot on your throat, it's really hard to talk to him.
So what comes next?
If the judge accepts our motion to amend the complaint, then that sets the stage for what I would believe would be a trial. We've been through all, I mean, the facts haven't changed. Nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is whether the 2005 JOA was operative, the amendment, or the 1989 JOA is operative. And that the judge will deal with over the next couple of weeks. She has a hearing set, I believe, around April 20th, where she's going to make that determination of whether the 1989 JOA is in effect. And if that happens, to me, the next thing to do is to set a trial date, because we've done all the depositions and all the discovery needed. There's nothing that's changing. It's just a matter of a date. And it's been 7 years.
In the meantime, do you try to get printed elsewhere?
We're gonna play this one out. We'll see what happens on April 20th or thereabouts after the hearing before the judge. I have no reason to believe that the judge isn't going to see that the 1989 JOA is in full force and effect. And if that's the case, then it's very clear from the 1989 JOA what the Review Journal's responsibilities are. So I don't need to go out and look for someone else to print our paper. I couldn't do it anyway, because I don't know to whom I should deliver it. They have all the subscriber lists. I don't know to whom I should go sell an ad. They have all the advertising contracts, and they won't give them over, right? Don't want, they don't, they only have to give them over to us if the JOA is over. The JOA, in our view, is not over, the 1989 JOA. So what they have to do is abide by it. And that's what the hearing will be in April 20th, I believe, is to determine that.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Of course, there's two parties to this suit. For their part, the Review Journal argues the litigation sought to end a, quote, structurally deficient, economically unsustainable, and not to mention legally unenforceable agreement, end quote. To better understand that argument, I spoke with Ben Littman, Chief Legal Officer for the Review Journal. Here's that conversation. Ben, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
On Friday, the RJ stopped printing and inserting the Sun into its daily print edition. Editor Glenn Cook wrote an op-ed describing the joint operating agreement as unenforceable and illegal. The Sun editorial team responded that afternoon, repeating their claim that the suit is over antitrust. How do you respond to their claims of unfair competition?
The agreement that they said required us to print their insert, which we refer to as the 2005 JOA, that's the one that the Ninth Circuit declared was unlawful and unenforceable. The Sun asked the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case and overturn it, and the Supreme Court said no. It went back down to the district court, back up a second time to the Ninth Circuit. They have made absolutely clear this is an unlawful agreement. The 2005 JOA itself is an anti-competitive agreement. JOAs are agreements that are in violation of the antitrust laws. Now, the Newspaper Preservation Act was enacted because Congress decided that in very limited, narrow circumstances, there may be other value to joint operating agreements that outweigh the fact that they are inherently anti-competitive and in violation of the antitrust laws. In the end, we realized this was not one of those agreements. The Attorney General did not approve it as required because it did not provide the benefits that overcame the natural anti-competitive combination that the JOA otherwise would be. So to claim that our refusal to follow an unlawful agreement that itself called for inherently anti-competitive behavior, that that refusal itself is anti-competitive, is turning the antitrust laws on their head. It's getting them in reverse. To do what the Sun wants us to do would be anti-competitive and in violation of the antitrust laws.
So help me better understand this most recent ruling. The Ninth Circuit essentially said that the 2005 operating agreement is invalid because the Attorney General at the time didn't sign off on it. Does that mean the terms revert back to the 1989 JOA?
No, that is not correct. It got rid of the 2005 JOA. The Sun is now arguing that the 1989 JOA is somehow in effect or should come back into effect as some zombie JOA that is being reborn. We do not agree with that. We think the law is clear that the 1989 agreement was terminated. If not terminated, it was certainly abandoned by the parties. It's impossible to perform, and it is not an agreement that binds the parties now.
So your argument is that the whole concept of JOAs are anti-competitive?
Well, the concept of JOAs in general, I think, had their place in our country in decades past. I think it made sense at certain times in our history. I don't think that they really do any good or make any sense now, which is why there are none left. I mean, there were at one time around 30 in the country for decades, and slowly they went away because of the changing nature of the media landscape. I mean, as we all know, newspapers don't just compete against other newspapers in their hometown anymore. I mean, I'm sure you think that NPR competes against newspapers. I certainly agree that they do. I can get my news from NPR, or I can get it from print newspaper. I can get it from websites. I can get it from podcasts. I can decide to watch Netflix instead. I mean, the idea that there isn't a vast amount of competition from a million sources out there just doesn't really make sense anymore.
When did the relationship between the Sun and the RJ sour?
Almost immediately after the current ownership structure was put in place, the Sun tried to get out of the JOA. They wanted it to be bought out, and they wanted it to stop publishing. And when they didn't get as much money as they wanted, they became very bad partners for us, and it became problematic. But nevertheless, we would have gone merrily along continuing to publish them. But when they sued us and started claiming antitrust violations, and we looked into the situation more closely, we realized, which we did not know originally, that the 2005 JOA had not been approved and therefore was unlawful. Had the Sun not sued us, we would have just kept publishing them and probably never realized that. Once we realized it and we were forced to deal with a partner that was not being a good partner in our minds, we went to the court, which we would have, I think, felt we had to do, even if we had a great relationship with them, which was honestly inform the court that this was an illegal arrangement. We weren't going to continue engaging in behavior that violates the antitrust laws.
So to sum up, would it be fair to say that from the Review Journal's perspective, you all see this relationship with the Sun as burdensome?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, this relationship has been and would continue to be a huge burden for us in time, effort, money, in all sorts of ways, not to mention that it hurts competition in this area and hurts consumers as well.
The Sun has said it will continue fighting this in court. How far, how long could this go?
I wish I knew, I guess, is the answer to that. I don't know. In part, it's going to depend on just how much the Sun is going to keep fighting and keep trying to come up with new ways to keep their case alive. They've come up with a few different theories, and every time one gets shot down, they come up with another one. And I really don't know how long it is going to go on, but we are going to stand up for our rights and stand up for the rights of consumers and keep fighting so long as they force us to.
You've talked a lot about competition, but doesn't having a differing editorial voice ostensibly make the RJ better?
Absolutely, and that's what we are encouraging. This agreement isn't competition between two newspapers. We encourage the Sun to stand up on their own two feet and continue and publish a newspaper and compete with us. We welcome the competition. We, of course, compete with all sorts of media. We have a million competitors, and we have no problem with one more. We just don't think that we should have to be the ones to pay for it. They're not going to go away if the JOA goes away. They still have a website. They have a weekly magazine. They have social media. They have a number of different publications, electronic and print. I mean, they're owned by one of the richest men in the state, and all we do is encourage him if he thinks that in addition to all of the other ways that the Sun's voice gets out, that he wants to add another print publication to that, that he be the one that pays for it.
Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Black Mountain Institute, based at UNLV, recently celebrated its 20th anniversary. University President Emerita Carol C. Harder founded the Southern Nevada Literary Institution in 2006. But that celebration came on the heels of less happy news. Last fall, the Rogers Foundation said it would be concluding its funding of BMI this June. A statement from BMI Executive Director Colette LaBeouf described that funding as foundational and said it would lead to a transition for the organization. LaBeouf declined to speak with us for this segment. And a note here, Nevada Public Radio's Desert Companion magazine does co-produce a podcast, BMI Conversations, which KNPR managing editor Heidi Kaiser hosts. Kaiser recently sat down to talk about what the Institute has meant to the Las Vegas literary art scene with Scott Dickensheets. He's a cultural critic and Desert Companion's editor at large.
Scott, thanks for sitting down with me to reflect on this.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So, Scott, you've followed this scene both personally and professionally for a good part of your life, if I'm not mistaken. To illustrate what the arrival of BMI might have meant to the community at large, maybe you can just start by telling me what it meant to you.
I'll start with an anecdote. When Carol Harder stepped down in 2014, I interviewed her for Desert Companion, and she told this great story about how she and her team had organized and laid the groundwork for kind of a far-reaching, nationally important conference on Hunter S. Thompson, author of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Perfect setting, perfect match. But the lawyers for Thompson's estate put the kibosh on it, saying that they were aghast, and that's the word she used, they were aghast at the idea that any kind of scholarly event like that could be held in a city so frivolous as this. So naturally, myself and other bookishly inclined people were delighted, I think, by the arrival of an organization that appeared to be like set to be seriously and confidently interface with a larger literary world in a way that hadn't really been done before or been done in a piecemeal way by various organizations here and there. So I, for one, was like really heartened by it.
Many people will know BMI through the people it brings to town through its programs and fellowships. Currently, we have K.B. Brookins, Isle McElroy, Muriel Lung, and Soretta Morgan. Who were some of the big names or the memorable people that you've met or heard speak over the years?
Well, I saw William Volman. I saw T.C. Boyle, which was really interesting because he was like a more of a mid-list kind of writer then, and yet he packed the house. So that made me think, like, there's more literary energy here than I had anticipated. I saw Rachel Kushner, I saw Leslie Jamison. These were all like really important writers in our time. The bigger list, of course, is the writers I wish I had seen. Toni Morrison, Walter Mosley, Joyce Carol Oates, Percival Everett. You could go on and on with the list. And panels that I wish I had seen, including, does it matter if Jesus was married? Which Carol Harder told me was one of her highlights of her tenure there. So it sounds funny, but also like very serious and far-reaching kind of thing. And I wish I had seen that. So many things that I wish I had seen and didn't catch that I hope lots of other people did.
And what was the impact of having those people here in this community?
Well, for one, I think it brought the literary world to Las Vegas, which, you know, doesn't really happen, you know, naturally by normal osmosis. And so hopefully we here get a sort of an injection of that literary, you know, mojo into our civic bloodstream. But one also hopes that the writers and the fellows in particular, after spending their time here, go back to their home turf and might have something interesting to say about Las Vegas that's not the normal sort of, you know, institutional downlook on us, and hopefully continue maybe the thawing that national indifference towards the literary activities of Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. What are some of BMI's other literary milestones that they've planted or passed over the last 20 years?
They've done a lot of things. It's not super well known, but it's kind of well known that they hosted North America's first City of Asylum, which offered a safe place for international writers chased out of their homelands by because of the things they wrote that met with hostility from the regimes in charge. And that is a terrific thing. And it happened here first in North America instead of all the other places you might think of it happening. They partnered with an organization called Archipelago Books to fund translations of international literature, including Carl Nausgaard's massive My Struggle series, which went 6 or 7 volumes. And that's not widely known either. They sort of funded a lot of that translation. So there's that. I think the Believer Festival, back in its heyday, did some really interesting things. You know, why not put a big reading out in the amphitheater at Red Rock Canyon?
Why did you leave your country? How old were you when you left that home? Why did you leave your country, your river, your stars, your tongue, the cemetery where your loved ones are buried?
Where did you go?
Why did you leave your country?
There's a magic in the desert. There are things that happen to us here that could only ever happen here.
Did you feel pressure to go?
Nothing was changed except us, but that change was tenuous, and whatever gain had been made needed to be stoked and grown.
That was like a terrific thing. They hosted a really interesting program in a building on the Review Journal campus where the Neon Museum stores old signs. And so they lit all those up and had readings and music and all kinds of presentations. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, sort of gets out of the auditorium panel scenario. And I think they did a good job of sort of taking that out into the community.
You mentioned the City of Asylum Fellow, and I would be remiss if I didn't point out that the current City of Asylum Fellow at BMI is someone from Iran. So you can get a sense of the impact from
yes,
that.
Yes, and there have been plenty of writers who were at risk of serious jail time or worse if they hadn't been offered a shelter here.
Mm. So those are some of the highlights. Let's talk about some of the lowlights, if you will. I'm thinking here of former executive director Joshua Wolfshank's departure and the subsequent loss of the Believer magazine. For folks who might not have been here when that happened, can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, Shank was a controversial figure anyway amongst a lot of people. And during a staff Zoom meeting, he inadvertently or accidentally exposed himself to the people who were on the Zoom. And that led to his pretty quick departure from the organization. But that was followed by a raft of complaints from some of the staff there about his management techniques, toxic management, they called it, that had gone unaddressed by the university. So then that sort of relationship was made complicated by that between the organization and the university. And that was sort of typified by their handling of the Believer magazine, which Shank had bought from its original publishers to have as the organ of the Black Mountain Institute. But it was very costly to run. And so once he was gone, the university, which had pulled the organization back into its orbit a little more closely, decided to get rid of it. And they immediately just sold it to a website that sold sex toys. And eventually it all worked out. You know, the guy very graciously sold it back to the original owners, and it's now doing its thing. But that was a very awkward and unfortunate episode. And it left a strange, you know, residue for a lot of people.
Mm, yeah, quite a scandal, as I recall.
Yes.
In BMI's November announcement about the loss of the Rogers Foundation funding, Executive Director Colette LaBeouf wrote, "Even as we face a new period of institutional change, we believe that BMI has real possibilities now and in the future." Scott, what would the community lose if it lost BMI?
That's a really good question. Obviously, the loss of the fellowships, which I hope continue on in some fashion, because I think that's a really good thing to bring those writers here, give them space to write, and also let them experience Las Vegas for what it really is and not the image behind it or in front of it. But I think we will lose an organization that, you know, had the vision and the, you know, the ambition to bring the literary world to our doorstep in a way that's done, you know, in part, you know, sometimes, you know, the Las Vegas Book Festival does it once a year, the Library District does it periodically, but not with a dedication and, you know, sort of foresight and attention to writers of different levels. Like, sure, they brought a lot of big name writers, but they also brought a lot of emerging writers. Richard Sykin, who's now sort of a top level poet, came here years ago as an emerging writer. And that sort of process repeats itself throughout the history of BMI. So a lot of writers who wouldn't have that opportunity got that opportunity because of Black Mountain Institute. And I hope, I think that that would be a real loss to us and to our outreach efforts in the sort of cultural space out there.
Scott Dickensheets is a Las Vegas cultural critic, my former boss, and the editor-at-large of Desert Companion magazine. Scott, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for letting me be here.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR's Heidi Kaiser. She's stepping in for Mike Prevett, who is out on vacation. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Paul. And I would like to just start by saying that I am in no way filling Mike's shoes. I just don't have the energy that would be required for that.
All right. Noted. So let's see what you've got for us this week.
Okay, so apologies to the Big Lebowski and their fans. I'm going to start by just quickly noting that the Eagles are playing the Sphere this weekend, Friday and Saturday, the 10th and 11th. That's at 8:30 both days, but there are only a few tickets left, and they're very expensive, around like $1,000. Still, they have won 6 Grammys, so I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't at least mention it. But moving on, something a little more my speed, Samara Joy is playing at Cabaret Jazz in the Smith Center.
All right. Speaking of Grammys, I believe she's got several as well.
That is right, including Best Jazz Vocal Album and Best New Artist for her second album, Linger a While, and an NAACP Image Award. All that, and she is only 26 years old. KNPR listeners will certainly have heard one of her many NPR interviews, and now they have a chance to hear that silky voice in person. Joy has been heralded as many things, all the way up to the superlative, the future of American jazz. And as Mike has mentioned before on this segment, live music lovers love Cabaret Jazz for its acoustics and atmosphere. So this could be a jazz fan's dream come true.
All right, so how do I get my hands on some of those tickets?
Well, there's just a few left. They're mostly around $100, though, which seems like a steal based on her popularity. So you'll want to get them soon if you would like to go, and that will be Friday, April 10th at 7:30.
Okay, so what if neither oldies rock nor jazz is your thing?
All right, so I've got one last music recommendation for you, and it's one that I know a few of my friends will love. It's the Las Vegas Bluegrass Festival. That's April 11th at Centennial Hills Park Amphitheater in Northwest Las Vegas.
Big bluegrass fan are you there, Heidi?
Well, it's not my jam, I'll admit, but bluegrass is well suited to the festival atmosphere because of its riffing, storytelling style. And this is the 10th installment of this one, according to the city of Las Vegas, which is hosting it. So they must be doing something right there. And the headliner is going to be singer-songwriter Ciara Hull. And the lineup also includes bands like Pitchfork and Page and the Overtones. The city says there will be a lot of other things going on besides music, including folk art, barbecue, beer, margaritas, and kids' activities as well.
Sounds like a family event when you put it that way.
Yeah, that's how it's built, and people are encouraged to bring chairs and umbrellas and lounge on the lawn. So definitely fun and relaxation is the vibe they're going for. And again, that's this Saturday. It's from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and it's completely free. But you can reserve a spot on Eventbrite if you are so inclined.
All right, let's move on from a good time to a good cause. You've got a fundraiser next, I understand.
That's right. It's Lead Library's Silver Soiree, which raises funds to support student employment at UNLV. The library is celebrating its 25th anniversary and inviting the public to join them.
So how do you celebrate a library?
With a soiree. And I had to say that again because I see you laughing at me, Paul. So I wondered that, too. Their website description is intriguing. It includes not only a slate of celebrity entertainers like magician Christopher Hart and comedian Matt King, but also what organizers describe as an immersive tour through the library itself, which will, and I am quoting here, reveal collections, innovation, and spaces in unexpected ways.
Definitely sounds intriguing.
Right. So whether it's that or supporting students that entices you, you can get a ticket for between $125 and $250. Check-in starts at 5:30 and the event starts at 6. And again, that's Saturday also.
And sticking with UNLV, you've got one more recommendation that's on campus.
That's right. Starting Monday, April 13th, that's, I know, a week out, but running through April 24th, people can see the MFA thesis exhibition of multidisciplinary artist Kayla Lockwood. It's called Read the Fine Print, and as Lockwood describes it, the work challenges the myth of home as a stable cornerstone of the so-called American dream. So I am pointing out someone's thesis exhibition because this one actually takes up two floors of the Don a Beam Gallery at UNLV, and it combines sculpture, installation, sound, architecture, so clearly an ambitious multimedia project. As visitors move through that space, the artist is walking them through an evolution from perception to reality.
Sounds like quite an experience. How do folks get into it?
So it is free, and the gallery is usually open from 9 to 5. That there will be multiple events held in conjunction with it, though. You'll want to check the website, though, to make sure that, you know, the gallery is open and it's open to the public.
And as always, we will have more information about it on our website, knpr.org. That's all the time we have for Heidi. Thank you.
Thank you.